2 weeks ago, we opened our exploration of Sefer Melachim in general, of Nevi'im Rishonim in general, and we focused our attention in particular, which we continue to do over the course of the series, on the stories of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, the stories, the tfilos, the miracles of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, one of David HaMelech's greatest grandsons. And last time we focused on the opening psukim of Perek Yudches of Melachim, which introduced Chizkiyahu the man. We meet Chizkiyahu, and there's a focus on his personal penis and some of his personal activities. The psukim described to us that he was someone who was in many ways a self-made man. He does immediately, the psukim tell us, "Vayas hayashav eni Hashem kachol she'asa David aviv." He was an incredible tzaddik in the model of David, his father. His father was not literally David HaMelech, but his literal father was no tzaddik. He described him as an oasis in the sea of Rishon. His son and grandson are both Rishon as well. His son in particular, Menashe, was, as the very next parak, Parak Hafaf, will tell us, Menashe was arguably the greatest Rasha of the Malchei Beis David, and the driver, the psukim tell us explicitly, of the Churban Bayis Rishon. Coming on the heels of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, who, as we'll explore in a later shiur, could have been, not only was there a great Yeshua that came in his time, but he could have been Mashiach ben David. So Chizkiyahu is surrounded by Rishon before and after him, but builds himself into one of the greatest tzaddikim of all time, because he reached back to the Masora of David HaMelech, and he took David as David Aviv, as his father David, and builds himself on that, plugs into that Masora and builds himself tremendously. And we saw last time, in the opening of Sokhman Perek Yichas, that he was a man of extraordinary bitachon. A man of extraordinary bitachon, and it expressed itself, his own personal connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu expressed itself as well in the way in which he sought to raise the Jewish people. And he got rid not only of Avodah Zarah, got rid of the Bamos, got rid of Nechash and Nechoshes. We explored that last time, that he was seeking to raise the level of Klal Yisrael's connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we left off that as a result, after the opening psukim that speak about his inner bitachon and the way in which he expresses himself in action, we see immediately, as the Mabel points out, and this brings us to where we're up to now, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hashkacha on Chizkiyahu HaMelech was remarkable. The sliding scale of hashkacha pratis that many Rishonim speak about, the Rambam, the Ramban, and others, that this hashkacha pratis in every human being, but at the same time, the more I draw myself close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the more HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be that much more hands-on and that much more direct in his hashkacha on me. So we saw that play out in the sort of hashkacha process that he enjoyed. Number one, Pasuk Ches, the last Pasuk, if you have the packet from last week, it's the last Pasuk on the first page. If you have this week's copies, so it's one pasuk before the copies pick up. He begins to rebuild. He begins to rebuild what had been Malchus Yehuda. Malchus Yehuda had already taken a hit under his father. Ashur had moved in, and his father had become a kafuf to Ashur. And Yechizkiyahu begins to rebuild. Who he calls Plishtim at Azav is Gvulea. He moves to the west. He regains the territory that had been taken by other nations. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu was watching it. And that's one expression of this sliding scale of Hashgacha Pratis, that they had remarkable success. And then it brings us to, we pick up on the Psukim Tes Yud, Yud Aleph, and Yud Beis is the contrast. It's in the fourth year of the reign of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, which is Shana Shviyas LaHoshea Ben Ela, the seventh year of the parallel Melech Yisrael. This is right his seventh year, and it is He is the last. Hoshea is the last of the kings of Malchus Yisrael. Because Shalmaneser, Melech Ashur, one of the emperors of Ashur, comes to Shomron, which is the capital of the northern kingdom, the capital of Malchus Yisrael. Vayatzar le'li siege to the capital. Vayul kedua miktzei shloshanim b'shnashesh l'chizkiah. The siege on Shomron begins in the fourth year of Chizkiah. It ends in the sixth year of Chizkiah. That is the end of Shomron. Shomron is taken after this close to three-year siege. And not only is Shomron the capital taken, but that's the end of the entire Malchus Yisrael. Vayegel Malch Ashur in Pasuk Yud Aleph is Yisrael. Ashura, remember Yisrael, in the context of Nevi'im Rishon, refers specifically to the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom, the Aseres, these are the Aseres HaShvatim. They're taken away, they're sent into Golos. He brings them to a series of places, Chavar, Chlach, Nahar Gozen, the cities of Madai. That's what Melech Ashur does. That's how Ashur ruled. I mentioned last time that part of the strategy that Ashur used, successive emperors of Ashur used in aggregating power, because one of the major political issues in building and maintaining an empire is maybe you have a powerful army and you can conquer this. You can conquer this country and make it a colony, conquer that country and make it a colony. Building is one thing, but maintaining is quite another. How are you going to maintain your control over an area that keeps growing and growing and growing? Your connection to your colonies is going to grow increasingly tenuous. So Ashur's solution was mass migration. And they would take over a country, and then they would move the inhabitants by the hundreds of thousands, sometimes by the millions, to a different place. And they rotated, you know, the people of colony A went and moved to area B, and meanwhile the people of area B were moved out to C, and so on and so forth. And they rotated their subjects to different places in order to maintain control. And that's exactly why the Aseres HaShvatim go into Golos. And as the Pesukim tell us elsewhere, he moves in the people of the land of Kusa into Malchus Yisrael, into Eretz Yisrael, and that's how we end up with the Kusa. They were part of this, so to speak, tragic, massive game of musical chairs that the emperors of Ashur played with other people's lives. As a matter of fact, actually the Gemara tells us that Ba-Sancheirev, Allah Sancheirev, Bibel as Kol HaUmos. Gemara talks about the fact that Sancheirev moved nations around, jiggled nations around, and the Chazal points out that there's halachic significance, lasting halachic significance to this strategic decision of the emperors of Ashur. And that is that the host of Dinim and the Chumash no longer apply because the categories that they speak of are no longer extant. There are particular dinim. There are dinim that apply to the Jewish people. There are dinim that apply to non-Jews in general. Those dinim apply, continue to apply. But you have a series of dinim in the Chumash that speak to particular nations. There are halachas about Edom. There are halachas about Moab. Halachas about Ammon. And part of the drama of Megillas Rus is Rus subject to the Isser against Ger from Moab marrying a born Jew. The answer was no, because Moaviv lo Moaviv. But that din was in force at the time of Rus. It's no longer in force now. It was no longer in force. It was already no longer in force by the time the Churban Bais Rishon, because of this pasuk and psukim like that. Because over the course of decades, Ba-Sancheirev, and it wasn't just Sancheirev, but we'll get to Sancheirev in a moment. He's not the first of the emperors of Ashur. He is, for our purposes, the most famous one. But here we're hearing about an earlier one, Shalmaneser. Melech Ashur was practicing the same hideous strategy of moving this entire nation somewhere else, move a different nation in. So we no longer, the people who live in Eretz Edom are not Edomim, ethnically. The people who live in Eretz Moab are no longer Moabim. The people of Mitzrayim are no longer Mitzrayim, no longer the same ethnic group that lived there at the time of Matan Torah. That's why all the dinim of Moab and Ammon and Mitzrayim and so on and so forth, they no longer apply, because Allah Sancheirev and the emperors of Ashur in general, Bilbulus Kalahumus. And then, this segment, this four pasuk segment ends with, after describing the realities on the ground, here's what happened. Shalmaneser came, set, laid siege, sacks the city of Shomron, the capital of Malchus Yisrael, conquers Malchus Yisrael as a whole, moves those Aseres HaShvatim out. Pasuk Yudbeis ends this segment, and why? This was an onesh for, as we explored a little bit last week, centuries of chet. Centuries and centuries of chet in Malchus Yisrael. We explored last year, 2 weeks ago. That Malchus Yisrael, the leadership of Malchus Yisrael, was consistently corrupt. Consistently built on Avodah Zarah, and Avodah Zarah employed cynically to maintain power. That's where the leadership was. That's where the people largely were. And after many centuries, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, "I've given you chances," and HaKadosh Baruch Hu pulls the plug on Malchus Yisrael. That is, as we mentioned last time, here we are in Perek Yud Ches of Malachim, the first of the three prakim of Chizkiyahu, Yud Ches, Yud Ches, and Chav, mentioned last time that although Nevi'im Rishonim typically teach lessons through the mode of storytelling, through narrative, every once in a while you'll have a segment, even Nevi'im Rishonim, that reads like Nevi'im Achronim. Where you put aside the telling of the story to discuss in Yanei Emunah directly, typically to discuss Schar V'Yonesh, to reflect on the machshava that arises from these stories. And Chizki, this three prakim of Chizkiyahu here, are bracketed both before and afterwards by that sort of prose, just Nevi'im Achronim style discussion. I mentioned before that the parak that follows speaks of Churban Bayis Rishon, that the decision to destroy Beis HaMikdash was a result of the acts, the horrific acts of Chizkiyahu son Menashe. It would be delayed, but the die was cast because of Menashe's Avodah Zarah. And the parak before, Perek Yud Zayin, speaks of the Churban of Malchus Yisrael and expands on what appears here as a single pasuk. That the Churban of Malchus Yisrael, the Gals of Aseres HaShvatim, at the hands of the Assyrian Empire, that was a onesh for centuries of chet in that society of Malchus Yisrael. So the contrast could not be clearer. We already heard this story at length in Perek Yud Zayin about the Gals of Aseres HaShvatim, the Churban of Malchus Yisrael. But it's repeated here in brief, with a highlight on the why, perhaps to set up the contrast between the pasuk before and this. That Chizkiyahu is an incredible boteach. Chizkiyahu is reaching heights of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that had not been scaled. Malchei Beis Davar were overall mostly tzaddikim, but no one had been to this level perhaps since David HaMelech. While at the same time that Malchus Yehuda is reaching incredible heights, Malchus Yisrael is dropping out entirely. The net result of centuries of disconnect from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and embrace of Avodah Zarah, Malchus Yisrael is gone. That speaks again to what we were saying before, the Malbim's point about the sliding scale of Hashkacha Pratis, that Chizkiyahu reaches unbelievable heights from his end of Kirvas Elokim, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is guiding him extraordinarily, and the opposite is true up north, in Malchus Yisrael. And then this brief retelling of Churban Malchus Yisrael is also meant to set up a contrast, not just to what came before, but what's to come. Because after hearing that the Churban of Malchus Yisrael took place over the course of years 4, 5, and 6 of Chizkiyahu, we then, the very next pasuk, jumps ahead back to Chizkiyahu and jumps ahead from year 6 to year 14. Uva arba esrei shana l'melech Chizkiyahu, ola sancheirev. almost a decade later, and now we have a different emperor, Sancheriv, Melech Ashur, and he comes back knocking, now that they've swallowed Malchus Yisrael, they're back for more. And specifically, they're back for Malchus Yehuda. I'll call our Yehuda Betzuros. He comes and conquers all of the fortified cities, all of the militarily powerful cities of Eretz Yehuda, with the exception of Yerushalayim itself. Such that, in the very next pasuk, Chizkiyahu is still in Yerushalayim. Chizkiyahu is Melech Yehuda, and he sends a message to Melech Ashur Lachisha. He sends a message to the city of Lachish. Lachish was probably at the time the second largest and most powerful city in Eretz Yehuda. It had already been conquered by Melech Ashur. Melech Ashur at this point has already conquered, they've come back, and they've already conquered most of Malchus Yehuda. Yerushalayim thus far has still been spared. And interesting what he says, the message that he sends in Pasuk Yudalad is, Chatasi, I've sinned against you. And we're looking here for clues. What happens over the intervening 8 years, from year 6 to year 14? I've sinned. Shuv me'alai, leave me alone, and I'll give whatever you expect of me. Esa shor titain li alai, titain alai esa. Whatever tribute you demand, now sounds like, now I'm ready to pay. And Melech Ashur turns around and says, he sends him and he invoices him an extraordinary bill. 300 kikar of silver, 30 kikar of gold. So before we even go on to see how Chizkiyahu responds and the next steps, it's just worth looking at these first two psukim to appreciate what happened in between. In those missing 8 years, so clearly what it sounds like from Pasuk Yudalad is Melech Ashur had read that there had been some sort of
demand
that he had initially accepted. And then he had rebelled. And Ashur came and Sancheriv comes and flexes and says, if you're not going to pay tribute, you know, that's the end of you, I'm going to eat you up. And proceeds to largely do that. And Chizkiyahu says, well, take it easy. Okay, let's renegotiate. I'm willing to pay. Send me the bill. I'll cover the bill. And Sancheriv says, sure. Here's your bill. Millions. You got to figure out. You try to work out what the contemporary purchasing power of that amount is an astronomical amount of wealth that he's asking for. And indeed, Pasuk says, Vav Chizkiyahu pays that bill. Yeah. Yeah, so that's what's fascinating. And where is this money coming from? Let's come to that in a moment, because you're right. In the very next pasuk, we're going to hear where did he get this money from, and a big part of it seems like it was coming from the Beis HaMikdash itself. And then somehow that didn't solve the problem, because in pasuk Yitzayin, Ashur is back, and now they come to Yerushalayim itself. So. But before I move on, it's worth pointing out the following. From Pasuk Yud Gimel and on, the balance of Perek Yud Ches, as well as all Perek Yud Ches and Perek Chav, the balance of the stories of Chizkiyahu and Melech appears, I think we mentioned last week, appear here as well as in Sefer Yeshayahu. A full four prakim, the psukim are almost identical. Here it's the Christians who divide the prakim. You're divided into three prakim, and they're divided into four. The psukim are almost identical. If you're looking for in Yeshayahu, it's prakim lamed vav, lamed zayin, lamed ches, lamed tes. I mean, the last four prakim before the Pirkei Nechama begin. Nachamu, nachamu, amid parak mem. At that point down, you have the Pirkei Nechama of Yeshayahu. The last four prakim before the Pirkei Nechama are telling the story of Chizkiyahu, beginning with this point. Only in Malachim do you have the sort of this introduction to Chizkiyahu himself, and the contrast. But from Pasuk Yud Gimel here and on, yeah, almost identical language in Yeshayahu. Now the Malbim points out, he says, the Pesukim, they're almost identical. I already wrote my Perush on Yeshayahu. I think he had published Yeshayahu, written and published Yeshayahu first. So he says, I'm not going to pull out your Yeshayahu, and you'll find the parish in the Pesuk, and no reason to repeat it here. But then he goes on to also point out the following. He says, but there are differences. And one of the interesting differences is the Lidin. And the interesting difference is the Lidin. Because the truth is, it appears in three places. It appears in Malachim, identically, almost identically in Yeshayahu. And then there's also telling of the story in Divrei Hayam. The Divrei Hayam is a retelling by Anshei Knesset HaGedola of the history of the entire period of Tanakh. Begins with Adam and runs through all the way to the end of the story of Tanakh. So in the Divrei Hayam Beis, Perek Chaf, they describe as well the story of Chizkiyahu and the siege, Ashur's siege in Yerushalayim. And Nal points out what's different is what came before. What came before in Malachim, the implication is that Chizkiyahu initially had been paying off Ashur. Ashur was the big man on campus. Ashur was the superpower in the area and was extorting protection money. They hadn't yet taken and conquered Yehuda, but he said, I'll let you be a vassal state. You can be sovereign to an extent, but you're going to have to pay heavy, heavy taxes. And apparently Chizkiyahu initially had offered to pay. What you see in Divrei Hayamim, the preliminary story, is that Chizkiyahu is building up Yerushalayim. Chizkiyahu is bringing people from the suburbs into Yerushalayim, into the walls of Yerushalayim, and he's redoing the waterworks that surround Yerushalayim. He's fortifying Yerushalayim for a long siege. He's battening down the hatches in Divrei Hayamim. So the Malbim says, that the answer is yes. He did both. Number one, he bought time. He was buying time with Ashur. He said, yeah, he's playing ball with Ashur, I'll pay you. And meanwhile, so then he got a reprieve so that Ashur would leave him alone for a couple of years so he could fortify himself and prepare himself to defend. And what's further fascinating is that Chazal address the various preparations that he makes. They say from Malachim part of the story and Divrei Hayam part of the story, and there's an intriguing machlokas. There's a brisa that appears at least twice in the Talmud Bavli, Maseches Pesachim Daf Nun Vav Amud Alpha, Maseches Brachos Daf Yud Amud Beis. I think we touched on this brisa already last week. Brisa says that there are three particular decisions that Chizkiyahu made that the Hodelo Chachamim, that the Chachamim embraced, and three other decisions they made, Velo Hodelo Chachamim, they were criticized. So last week we spoke about the Hodelo Chachamim included destroying the Nechash and Nechoshes. That was one of the positive decisions. It was radical. It's an artifact from Moshe Rabbeinu, and he smashed it. Seems like it was a terrible act. No, that was the right thing to do, Hodelo Chachamim. It was right that we discussed last week. It was right. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to make Nechash and Nechoshes, but that was no longer relevant. Now is their time to smash it. But the Brisa says two of the three things he did, v'lo hodu lo chachamim, are the initial decision Divrei Hayamim, and the upcoming decision here. The fact that he rerouted the water system, that he rerouted the Mei Agichon, lo hodu lo chachamim, that was inappropriate. Another one, Lahod Lachachamim, is Pasuk, as our list pointed to before, Chizkiyahu is continuing to pay. Now the bill got even bigger, so where is he drawing funds from? Pasuk Tezayin, he's initially ready to pay and to pay more. And it's he cuts off the precious doors of the Heichal, and some of the other precious metals in Beis HaMikdash, and he gives them to Melech Ashur to pay the bill. So the Brisa that appears in the Bavli says that was terrible. That was wrong. Both of these are these two events, the Chizkiyah's preparations for the showdown, the ultimate, the looming showdown with Ashur, the Bavli, the Bryce and the Bavli says those are wrong. Well, because Rav Yigal Ariel, quotes a Koheles Rabbah that mentions these same two episodes in a positive light. Koheles Rabbah actually references language, a trio of ideas that should be very familiar to us from Rashi coming up in a couple of weeks. The Koheles Rabbah says, Chizkiyahu prepares himself, Hiskin Atzma L'Shlosha Dvarim, three preparations, Tefillah, Doron, and Milchama. Sounds like Yaakov Avinu. So the Medrash says, same as for Chizkiyahu. He davens, we'll hear about his davening, and the Tefillah is going to come in Parak Yates, in the next Parak, and L'Doron, where is the Doron? Ba'isa Hiki, Tzeis Chizkiyahu Melech, Pasuk Tezayin. And L'Milchama, at that point, the Kalash Rabbah mentions the Pasuk in Divra Yamin, Beis Perakav, Vayas Shalach, that he began to rebuild. He was restructuring Yerushalayim to fortify for the upcoming encounter. This is interesting. The Kalash Rabbah says this was appropriate, like Yaakov Avinu, Hiskin Atzma, both the military preparation of Divra Yamin and the diplomatic move in Melachim were both appropriate. While in the Bavli, it's assumed that the Tanam in the Bavli, the Machlokas, Tanam of the Bavli, saw it as inappropriate. Rashi there explains that what was wrong? The Kitzetz, Dalsu Zeicha, there we sort of intuit, I don't think you give away based on Mikdash. On the other hand, Pikoch Nefesh is Docha Mi'ila. And what was wrong with what he did with the water system and the refortifying Yerushalayim? So Rashi says these express the lack of bitachon. Particularly, why is that lack of bitachon? That's always a question of bitachon versus ishtadlus. And part of the bitachon ishtadlus defining the line, Chazanish points out that part of defining the line of bitachon versus ishtadlus is what's appropriate, what's inappropriate, is are you doing reasonable things or are you just grasping at straws in a panic? In other words, do you recognize that Kadosh Baruch Hu runs the world and out of a place of consequent calm, I'm saying, okay, what would be the reasonable thing for me to do? As well, what does Kadosh Baruch Hu want me to do? That's appropriate bitachon. I'm acting out of calm and taking reasonable steps. As opposed to Chazanish says, when I'm just grasping at straws and doing things that aren't really a reasonable response, just trying to do something, so that bespeaks a panic that expresses a lack of recognition that Kadosh Baruch Hu ultimately is running the situation. So that's one aspect of defining the line of between appropriate and inappropriate shtadlus. Is it reasonable or is it unreasonable panic?
What tunnel that we go in Yerushalayim? What a tunnel that we walk through in Yerushalayim?
I believe that is, and
that's lo hod lo chacham. And so we never really make a point. We're walking through this.
Maybe if you walk through it, you're following the Kaal's route. The water tunnels. Yeah. Great.
He says, no, I'm not going to pay. God's going to deflect all your bullets. There's no evidence.
Good.
Rabbi Cohen, one more point on the, difference between panic and reasoned response. It seems like the redirecting of the water in Chizkiyahu's tunnel was successful. So it really seems like it was reasoned.
Yeah, so that we need to, so we're trying to figure this out. So if, as the Chazanish said, look, if the question is reasonable or unreasonable, is this rational or panicky? So then you got, so we understand the Kalas Rava, that Hod Lo Chachamim, these were appropriate responses. I how you understand the lo hod lo chacham of the Brayis and the Bavli, that perhaps that speaks that maybe it's a machlokus over, would this really have helped? One response might be, with all the money in the world, they're coming anyways. So you want to give them some money, Mela, but to start deconstructing the Beis HaMikdash, it's not really going to help. Perhaps. Alternatively, another, maybe the Bavli is leaning on another angle. Because another issue in determining the line between appropriate and inappropriate hashtadlus, several Rishonim, Rama writes this in more than one place, it goes back to that question of the slightest skill of Ashkacha Pratis, that it goes both ways. Rama writes, I believe both Ramban and Rama both touch on this idea, that it could be that if I'm a greater Baal Madrega, so then the definition of what's appropriate Hishtadlos shrinks. The person is unusual tzaddik, so Kadosh Baruch Hu will be that much more hands-on with me, and therefore, what constitutes appropriate Hishtadlos is less than otherwise. Then maybe the Pshat, the Chazon Ish actually, in Muna B'Tachon quotes a Medrash, I believe it's a Bereishis Rabbah, I remember for sure, comment on Pasuk in Tehillim, Shreya Gever, Shasam Bashem Miftacha V'lopanel Rahav. Ashrei is the fellow who has B'Tachon HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Medrash says that, that's Yosef HaTzadik, great B'Tachon, V'lopanel Rahavim. He, as a result, such a person won't turn to aristocrats. Mesh God and say, Yosef did, and therefore he was punished. So how does it flow? He's told me he was great Potech, and now he's telling me he was Ponel Rav. And it raises the other question, which is, and why was it sinful to be Ponel Rav? It seems like very reasonable Hishtadlus. So the Chazon Ish takes his approach. He thinks that V'derech HaTeva, once the politician is gone, there's no reason to assume that he's going to remember you later, which is a particular assumption, psychological assumption he's making. And based on that assumption, he says, you know, it was acting out of panic, so it wasn't the reasonable hashtadlus. Alternatively, with this other angle, you might also say, Yosef was an unusual boteach, and that's the first half of the medrash. Asher sam Hashem Miftacho, Zeh Yosef, who was, in general, an extraordinary boteach. And perhaps, therefore, the threshold of what was appropriate hashtadlus for him was different than what it would be for me. He therefore should not have been Ponel Rahavim. When he was, for him that was indeed a chet. So that may be part of what's going on here. Also, maybe the Brisa in the Bavli thinks that these were unreasonable responses, though it strikes us offhand as being reasonable. Or maybe the Brisa in Bavli is saying it may have been reasonable, but for Chizkiyah, we just got finished saying the Chizkiyah was such an extraordinary boteach. So he should have limited his hashtadlus in a way that he did not. And then what happens? So then it is said he pays the astronomical inflated tribute for a while, and he pays the astronomical tribute. It holds off the Ashurim for some time, but then they're back. In Pasuk Yubeis they're back. V'yikach melech Ashur is tartan, and he takes his chevra. They come from Lachish to Chizkiyahu HaMelech. V'chel kaved Yerushalayim, with a very, very significant military presence. And they come up to Yerushalayim, and they stand in the Talas HaBrecha El Yonasha B'mitzilas Tei Koves. There was a street in ancient Yerushalayim called the Washerman's Field Road. Sometimes roads have funny names. Some have written, try to figure out what that means exactly. There was some area where either they were washing the clothing or where they were pressing the clothing. There was a street called Washerfield Road. So they Washerfield Road appears elsewhere in Sefer Yisrael as well. A couple of important events occur there. At this time, the emissaries, the envoys of Melech Ashur appear there. They are coming from Lachish. It's interesting. I point out that in Micha as well, the first parak of Micha, Micha was also one of the Nevi'im of the Malchei, the Yehuda of this period. He also describes, I point out in Dat Mikra, he also describes the armies of Sancheirev coming from the southwest, from the area of Lachish, while in Yishayahu, Ruin Yishayahu, in Parak Yud, and when he's giving one of his speeches, giving one of his Nevuas, he prophesies about the coming of Sancheirev, he describes as coming from the Shomron. So this is actually a blow-up of one page from the Dat Nikra Atlas, which is fantastic. So they point out that it seems like there was a pincer move. It seems like Ashur was coming from both sides. He's coming. They had already conquered the north. He's coming Yishayahu describes him as coming down from the Shomron, coming set from the north, while Micha, and here in Sefer Melachim, we're hearing about him coming up from Lachish. So they're sort of attacking, squeezing Yerushalayim from both sides. So this is incredibly frightening. Yerushalayim is under siege. They meet them specifically, the emissaries appear at the Talasa Brecha Eliona, at one of the water area, part of the waterworks, perhaps, pulling all those threads together, saying, we know you paid your tribute, but you're also, while you thought we were looking, you started fortifying Yerushalayim, playing around the waterworks. We know what you're trying to say. We know what you're trying to do. You think you're going to run your own game? We're back, and we're going to destroy you. We're going to absolutely destroy you. And they call for the king. So the king sends out several of his members of his cabinet, in Pasuk Yudches, Eliakim, and Shevna, and Yoach, and they come out to speak to have this meeting with the emissaries of Ashur. Rav Shakeh, in Pasuk Yudches, we have a couple of, just a couple of minutes left, let's sketch out what's going to happen. Rav Shakeh, over the course of the rest of Perek Yudches, Rav Shakeh is the spokesman for Ashur and proceeds to give two speeches in which he says, it's time to give it up. It's time to give up. Just surrender to us and you'll be okay. What's fascinating is over the course of his two speeches, he gives two speeches which are, as Rev. Ariel points out, totally the same message, you ought to give up, but in so many ways opposites of one another, and in so many ways speak to Rav Shakeh's psychological insight. The first speech, which begins here in Pasuk Yutes and runs through Pasuk Chafei, is very, very frum. It's very religious. The second speech, which runs from Pasuk Chav Zayin through Pasuk Lamed Hei, is riddled with kfir. The first speech, he addresses himself mostly to the king. And in the second speech, he addresses himself directly to the people. When Pasuk Chavav, in between the two speeches, the emissaries say, you know, please speak to us in Aramaic. We understand Aramaic, don't speak in Hebrew, because everyone else, all the soldiers on the top of the wall, the Jewish soldiers, they're going to hear you. And that's when he says, I'm talking to them. He transitions from a very firm speech to, he immediately launches into Nevel Peh. He says, I'm speaking to all those, all the Amcha Yerushalayim, who are, he says, in Pasuk Chav Zayin, eating their feces and drinking their urine, which is both speaks to how bad the conditions that become Yerushalayim within the siege, but also if there already had been such a siege, but also speaks to the shock value over the course of the first speech of Rav Shakeh. He talks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says, yeah, you have bitachon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Don't rely on Chizkiyahu. He got rid of the vamos. He's anti-Hashem. And he echoes some of the language of Yishayahu himself, that don't rely on Mitzrayim, Pasuk Chafav, the Kanero Tzut, the thin reed that's going to crack. Nah! He says, and in Pasuk Chafei, he says, you think HaKadosh Baruch Hu? I came because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said I should come. Very religious. And then when Eliakim pushes back, and they say, oh, and he totally switches, he puts it almost like playing good cop, bad cop. In the second speech, he's going to mention Shem Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei as well, but now it's only quoting, oh, Chizkiyahu says to rely on Hashem? Absolutely not. In the second speech, he starts with the Nevel Peh, and right away it's us versus them. It's Ashur, it's Hizkiyahu. You have to make choices. Chizkiyahu says he has God on his side, he has Hashem on his side. He says, look around at all the other. In Lamed Pasuk Lamed Dalet, he says, look around at all the other Avodah Zarahs. Did they save any other countries? I've been eating country after country. You're the only ones left. You think your Yudke Vavke, he says in his Kfira, is going to save you any more than the Lahavdil, gods of the other nations, save them? He says, total switch. And at the same time, he appeals directly to the people. In Sukkim Laman Aflan Beis, he says, come with me. I'll take you to another land. It'll be nice. You'll have food. It'll be a great place. Don't listen to this Chizkiyahu. He's trying to convince you that Hashem is going to save you. It's all a bunch of nonsense. So this is, we saw it militarily. Ashur came from both sides, the pincer move. And now psychologically, verbally, Rav Shakeh is also coming from both sides. First, the appeal to the king and the appeal to their better selves. And it's with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu also, Hashkafa Pratzis wants us. And then he comes with the talking tough. And the perek ends in a terrible place. They come back, they don't say anything. Mitzvah HaMelechi Leimar Lotanu. They were under strict gag rule, don't respond, which is smart. But they come back, in the final pasuk of the parak, they come back with Kriya. Kriya because of the Kfira and the Chirif and Gidif that they heard. Kriya because of what sounds like impending Churban. This parak ends in a frightening place. But we opened with the Bitachon, that's about to express itself Mitzvah in 2 weeks from now. We'll pick up with the middle parak of Chizkiyahu. In parak Yotes, we're going to hear Chizkiyahu respond with tefillah and with turning. We haven't yet heard by Yishayahu HaNavi. In the middle parak, we're going to meet Yishayahu for the first time in this context. And Chizkiyahu is going to turn to Yishayahu, and we're going to see the Havtacha of Geula promised by, followed by the actual Geula. From Al-Saf, it's all going to, it seems as though everything is about to fall apart here. We're going to very quickly come to the place of, by in the Parak Yates, where this miraculous Yeshua, what almost became, not only Yeshua, but what almost became Geula Shlema, if Chizkiyahu would have been Melech HaMashiach. So we end here at a frightening moment. We're about to turn the page to see Yeshua Hashem begin to unfold. I'm glad to take questions outside. I think Davin's got to begin here.